Coming up on 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show here on WGTD. In part one of our program, a college professor goes back to college as a freshman student to find out just what exactly the freshman college student experience is. In part two, we hear from one of the world's most renowned chefs, Eric Ripert. Stay tuned. As many of you know, my full-time job is as assistant professor of music over at Carthage College. And so you can understand the special delight and fascination I had in reading a new book called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student. The author, Rebecca Nathan, is actually an anthropology professor at a large university, but found herself, in a sense, increasingly baffled by her students, by what made them tick, and in particular, what forces were at play that sometimes kept some of them from really working to their full potential? What were the other things in their lives that were keeping them from doing as well as they could in the classroom with what should have been their central work? So she did what anthropologists do when they want to study a given population. She went and lived among them. In this case, impersonating a freshman student, maybe that's not even the right word. She became
probably not the right word.
She became a freshman student and then studied very carefully those around her and wrote about it in this book called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student, published by Penguin Books. And Rebecca Nathan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg.
Really glad to have you here. At one point in the book, you liken this experience, or maybe someone you know likened it, to that experiment that was undertaken some years ago by someone who injected themselves with some sort of dye and tried to live as a black man. Mm-hmm. Compare this experience to that one.
Well, I brought it up in the book just because I think the comparison is a little overdrawn, you know, and that it's interesting that so many people saw it that way because they saw what going back, a professor becoming a student, is as radical as changing your race. So I did think that was kind of funny. In some ways, it was very radical for me. I didn't expect to learn as much as I did learn from the student point of view, because when you walk and act like a student, And you take five classes, and you live in the dorm, and you try to be in clubs, and you try to have a social life as well at the university, you really see how difficult school can be. Mm. And I really learned from doing it that way, just the multiple demands that were really on my life, and I came to have a lot more compassion for my student's position.
Hmm. You ended up registering for classes and taking classes and living in a dorm. I mean, absolutely living the life of a college freshman. And
what
was so intriguing is, on one level, of course, you knew a lot about college freshmen. You dealt with them all the time. But as a teacher to students and not as a peer, you talk at one point about how this experience of becoming a student yourself was sort of like stepping through the looking glass, and all of the sudden you were encountering these students and connecting with them. I mean, not the very same students, but similar students, connecting with them in an entirely different way and knowing so much more about their world, a world which they didn't share with you when they knew you were the teacher.
That's right. And it's not, you know, it's not only that they shared with me, it's that I got to walk in their shoes. That was probably what I learned most from, was just having to do what I asked them to do. And I just found that it was more difficult. I was not a straight A student. My colleagues are very surprised. I found it an organizational nightmare to have to take five separate classes and do all the diverse things that students are doing today, which is different from when I went to school.
Hmm.
Most students now, in addition to taking their five classes and then they're being in professional groups and in volunteer groups because they're worried about what things are going to look like. They don't only need the degree, they need more things on their resume when they get out. They feel that way, that there's more competition. And so they're doing more things like that. They're also partying and having a social life. But what's different is that they're also working. And that's 10 to 20 hours a week, many of them. And that was something very different from when I went to school.
As you said about doing this work as an anthropologist, you call yourself a participant-observer.
Yes.
Which, of course, was really challenging then. I mean, for you to take on the work burden of a typical college student and at the same time having to be especially observant of it and writing about it. Tell us especially about this matter of field notes. I mean, how did you compile all the information which you were taking in as an observer?
Well, every night for myself, I would kind of write my own diary. And that was the stories of what happened to me during the day and my life as a student. And then I also interviewed students, and that I waited till my second semester to do. I interviewed students and I did focus groups. Now, those were done through the more normal research protocol that an observer would have to go through. So then I would sit them down and tell them that I was writing this for a book, and could I have their permission to do this interview and use their words or their stories. And so for that, I got a kind of, you know, permission to be able to do that, and those were more formal interviews. But a lot of what I was doing was keeping my own diary and then taking note of all the things in public space that I could, the things on the wall, the things on the doors, on the outside of the doors, you know, that face the hall, the way the cafeteria, you know, people ate and sat in the cafeteria, things that were available in public space were also very much part of my note-taking.
And some of the most fascinating stuff in the book. Let's talk for a moment about the things that people would put on their dorm room doors or the little bulletin boards beside them, the kind of pictures which they would post. I mean, you took the time to to really look at those kind of things and to try to figure out why students were choosing to post the particular pictures which they did. It's such an interesting matter.
Right, and it's a really cultural rather than psychological thing. And I think if you ask most students, and I have since in my classes, they'll say, hey, this doesn't mean anything. It just is somebody's interest areas is what they put up on the door. But when you really look at it as an anthropologist, which is different, you really see patterning. You see that it's not just interest. There's only certain kinds of pictures that go up on the doors. And those pictures tend to be me partying, me with my friends, me in crazy positions, me with my tongue sticking out, me with, you know, that's kind of the pictures that go up on the door. Or music posters, celebrities go up on the door, good-looking men and women, scantily clothed, go up on the door. Those things, your picture of your mother doesn't go up on the door. It does go in your dorm room. But it's not the public image that you want to convey.
You want
to convey freedom and individuality and coolness.
You say many of the photos, just as the words, phrases, and images included, are calculated to say something like, here I am doing crazy, spontaneous, fun things. Here I am having a good time with my friends. Or sometimes I'm a unique and eccentric individual. But even that is sort of a calculated plan to tell the world what you want them to think of you.
Yes, and that eccentric thing is so, you know, is so true because in my own classes now, one of the things I'll do is take people, after they've read this, take them to the dorm room and let them look at the doors and let them do the analysis. And what surprises me is that they say, you know, I never saw it that way before. And now that I see it that way, I can't stop seeing it that way. And I realize that my own door that I thought is so different and unique really has these same properties.
Right. You know, I think of my office door and my office where I teach, and I sometimes find myself thinking about it differently. Have I covered my office door with all kinds of funny cartoons and crazy pictures and this and that in order to make some kind of statement to the world about who I am?
I'm sure you have. And, you know, and we make a faculty statement about who we are. Because if you look at our doors, that would be a great study for some student to compare faculty doors and student doors, and you'd see different values being represented.
Absolutely. You talk about how that first week before classes start, when everyone's just on campus, that it's this kind of beehive of activity, all kinds of things planned, but that as soon as classes start, campus life becomes something very different, and sort of real life goes on. People retreat to their own lives, to their insular social groups. And at that point, it became quite a challenge for you to, in your words, get the sense of the rhythm of people's lives. And I guess it partly comes down to the fact that everyone has a different rhythm going on. Everyone's living a slightly different life at that point.
Yes, and, you know, the contrast between, this is really structured by the way our society works and the way our universities now work. The big university that has so many options in it that you could have 1,000 different people, each living a different schedule. And it really was brought home to me by a Korean student who said to me after the first week, she was also a first-year student like myself, and she said, I can't understand how to get involved with anybody. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, in Korea, when we finish a class, everybody goes out to lunch together. And here, the minute the bell rings, everyone's gone and they scatter. And I just saw in that some cultural things about us, that we do so much with choice, and the ability to go and come as you want and take classes at the times that you want, that we end up having schedules that really don't overlap that much. And it's hard to get together for meals and to be able to do the rest of it.
Yeah, people
really have to think about it.
Right, have to really make decisions towards that end. You also talk about how this really flies in the face of what many colleges, certainly my college, likes to talk about, this idea of community. But you say it is hard to create community when the sheer number of options in college life generate a system in which no one is in the same place at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, there is this incredible complexity to what someone called the over-optioned public university or college system.
Yeah.
And the sense of cohesiveness, which one might sense in a tightly knit community, that is all but impossible to achieve in this kind of scenario.
Well, it is, but I think that universities are now wrestling with that same question across the country. I'm talking at maybe 25 universities this year that are calling me and say, you know, we see the same problem. What are you guys doing? What are you guys doing? I think we're all trying to address how to make a sense of community and a little university within these big universities that we have. And there are various ways that different colleges are trying to do that, often by having living and learning environments where people who live together will also take classes together and to have meals together. And I think the freshman year experiences, that they're trying to make them more community-based.
Hmm. You talk about how often things will be put together that are either community, campus-wide, or at least all the freshmen will maybe have to take a given seminar course. But you talk about how almost always any sort of required common experience is terribly unpopular. I mean,
yeah.
This is a real uphill battle in a sense.
Right, and that's the rub, and it has to do with not just students today, but it's the nature of the United States and the country we live in. We value so much this idea of individual choice that it's very hard for people to accept that there's one thing that they have to do, and that it's required, and that they don't get any choice within that.
Hmm. Well, you touch on a real truth here, which is that college students are just a reflection of our overall society.
Indeed.
And you say, when you talk about people, wherever they might be, they might genuinely want to have a close community, while at the same time, they resist the claims that community makes on their schedule and resources.
That's
in the name of individualism, spontaneity, freedom, and choice. Those are all things that we all love. But
right.
they come at a price, in a sense.
Right, and it's a real tension within our lives, even as adults.
One thing, too, in terms of this idea of community on a college campus, you talk about how certain things will pull students in, things like Greek organizations, fraternities, and sororities, and create what I guess one person called little loyalties, in which around people will gather. I think someone else talked about the orbital energy that is part of some of these smaller organizations, but that small circle might be in itself its own community, but in a sense it also is pulling students and their attention away from the greater community that one might want to create.
That's right. It's the same tension over again. The very ways that we think of at universities to create these small communities sometimes pulls people away. This is some of the argument that's being made against Greek systems, but it's also against systems like black student unions that say it's pulling those students away. The only argument I have with that for something like a black student union is that, at least in my research, I found that students of color in general are mixing much more with people different from themselves than white students are. And it's in part the numbers involved at most universities. But if you look at the eating arrangements or you look at the social networks of students. And this is really a disturbing factor for some of us who are very committed to diversity at the university. We would expect that there's much more of social groups and eating together that are going to be mixed because classes are mixed. But what you find really is that when students go to eat together in the university cafeteria, that it's not as mixed as you would want it to be.
Hmm. I want you to tell our listeners about one adjustment you made when you really started studying this question of diversity and asking students, who are your friends? And do you have friends here at this college or university that are from another ethnic group? You ended up, I think, midway through your study kind of playing with the questions you were asking or the way you were asking the question, and it made quite a difference.
I did, because I realized at some point that when I said, do you have people in your social network who are different from yourselves ethnically, I would get a PC answer. I would get the answer that people thought was the right thing to say, which is, absolutely I do. And then I would ask them for a name of that student, and they would say, John from my economics class. He's a good friend of mine, and he's a person of color, or he's a white person, and the person talking to me is a person of color. And what I found when I just didn't notice that. I didn't see that happening as much as people said it was true in their social networks. I didn't see it in the lunchroom. And so I thought to change the question. And instead of asking them that, I asked them, who are your closest friends? And they would name 5 people, 6 people, 7 people. And I would take all those names, and then later in my interview, I would ask them about their ethnic background, about their majors, about their other things about that student.
Those friends that they listed.
Right, I'm sorry, those friends. And what I found out doing it that way is that people really gravitate to their own, and that their social networks are really pretty much people like them. And again, it was less true for people of color. And that's why I think special student unions and special programs are good for students of color who are often in the minority and therefore always interacting with people different from themselves.
Hmm.
It's the white students who aren't.
So that really puts that in a different light.
That
maybe these ethnically based unions, like a black student union, are giving them something which they otherwise are not experiencing in the day-to-day.
That's right.
They're experiencing more diversity in their social circles than the typical white student, for instance.
Exactly.
But that helps explain this need.
Exactly. And that's made me think about these issues differently, and that it's not a blanket policy that we do or we don't have these organizations. It seems like we should and we shouldn't, depending on what those organizations are.
And a corollary to what you're just saying in terms of us gravitating to who is like us, you tell many different stories about how, on Super Bowl Sunday, your particular RA would set up a couple of giant screen televisions in the lounge.
Right.
And, there might be 3 people that would show up for that sort of community event. And you'd find all kinds of clusters of students gathered in their own dorm rooms with their own tight circle of friends watching the Super Bowl.
You know, that's absolutely true, and it was one of my biggest insights in this freshman year was that Super Bowl experience, because what it showed me, and you have to understand that this was in an upper-class dorm. This was not in a freshman dorm. What I hear from the freshmen really is that, and really from freshman advisors too, is that freshmen do have community, but they have it for a limited time. And what the people at my university say is, once you come to spring break of the first year, that's kind of the cutoff point. Sometimes it happens as early as Thanksgiving. but it's the time when people are open to that larger community, and they're trying to make these networks. They're trying to make these friends. But then once they do, and they pretty much do during their freshman year, the deed is done. And they often keep those same networks throughout their college career. And what it makes me think about as a professor is how I could help to mix it up a little bit, how I could introduce them to more people, because they really are staying with the people that they've met early, and the people they've met early are also are often the people just like them.
Hmm. When we start getting into matters more academic than social, you really discovered some interesting things as well. And one of them, you seem to develop a real appreciation for what your students had been living through, the fact that a given student in a college is subject to a number of different masters.
Yeah.
You said, as a student, I was quick to learn you serve many masters, each with his or her own quirks, schedules, and predilections. And up to then, you hadn't thought much about that. You mostly just thought about your classes, your students, and the demands you were making, not real cognizant of the other demands which were being made on those same students by other teachers in other classrooms.
And absolutely. I mean, all my rules and my way of doing things are to make my classes work. And I really didn't think of all the other things that were being demanded of them in other classes.
You talk about how time management is something which has been talked about quite a lot among college freshmen, but that in fact it's more a matter of college management that is maybe a more appropriate way to phrase it.
Absolutely, and I think you're getting to some of the core issues here. The strategies the administration tells us to use as students is time management, which is basically don't party so much. Make sure that you do homework every night and you keep up to date, and you put all the exams in a day planner so that you know when things are due. And that is good advice. But in addition to those kind of organizations, what I found is that what good students do, the students who taught me, is college management. And what that meant is that they learned how to schedule their classes so that they had a good balance of hard and easy courses, of big survey courses and seminars. They created schedules that leave them blocks of downtime so that they could either work or party. They learned how to professor shop so that they knew what the work demand was in a class. And one of the things they learned, which finally explained to me something that I never understood, they learned when not to do the readings. And it really gave me insight into why a third of the students, if I'm lucky, when I assign a reading, will do it, unless I'm giving a test that day.
You call it strategic corner cutting.
Yes.
Which is a really great way to put it.
I found, surprisingly, that I was doing some of the same things just in order to get through my classes. I came to realize which professors weren't really using the reading in the class. And I didn't read that. And I was shocked at myself some of the time. But I just ended up doing what natives did, I guess. I came to the same conclusions as them, as they.
One thing that is so interesting about this experience for you is that it helped you see this world in which you live in such a different way. You talk very early in the book about sort of a new gift for noticing just everything. You say, I find myself constantly taking apart the taken-for-granted world in which I live. And that's probably an experience that probably a lot of professors need to have, to not just take for granted the dynamics they find in the classroom or the way they interact with others, but to try to understand what's going on there. What kind of a difference has it made for you?
Well, it certainly is now changing the way that I teach. And one of the insights that I had from students is that they certainly came to college to learn, but most of what they learn, and they're telling me two-thirds of what they learn, is outside of the classroom. They're learning it in peer situations. They're learning it in life situations. And one of the things that I started thinking about is whether in the classroom I could tie in to those outside experiences better to make the classes more relevant. Because after all, these are their values, and these kids are very practical. They're in major debt from going to school. They want learning that they can use. They want learning that is relevant to them. And so I started a class called The Anthropology of Everyday Life. And in that class, we do a lot of things outside of the classroom as well as inside. We do data collection in the dorms. We do we go into the life of the college in order to look at some of the phenomena I'm asking them to look at. I do more with practical learning, more with case studies, more with service learning, and more with cooperative learning, because students respond to peers. And so there's more discussion, more things that they're doing with one another. And it's really changed my teaching methods, but it's slow. I mean, I'm still in the middle of it, and I'm transforming most of my courses away from a lecture format.
Well, maybe another book will be in the offing a couple years down the road. Well, this book certainly was tremendously interesting and entertaining, really, as well. Again, called My Freshman Year, What a Professor Learned by Becoming a Student, a publication of Penguin, the author Rebecca Nathan. Rebecca Nathan, I'm so glad we got to talk about this, and best wishes to you in your teaching career, and thank you again for joining me today on The Morning Show.
And you too, Greg. Thank you.
8:42 the time. You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Here's part two of today's program. In part two of today's morning show, we're going to be hearing from one of the world's premier chefs, Eric Ripert, responsible for a number of different important cookbooks, including a book called Avec Eric, A Culinary Journey with Eric Ripert, and On the Line, The Stations, The Heat, The Cooks, The Costs, The Chaos, and The Triumphs Inside the Walls of Le Barnardin, which is his highly acclaimed restaurant. Season three of his series, Avec Eric, is about to premiere on the Cooking Channel. Here is a portion of a conversation which I had the pleasure of recording with Eric Ripert a couple of years ago upon the publication of his book, On the Line. Again, we play this today in anticipation of this weekend's premiere of season three of his series, Avec Eric, in which he journeys around the world to help celebrate the world of delicious food. I love the definition which you give at one point about cuisine. You say at its heart, it is about flavor, the act of recognizing the attributes of a specific ingredient and understanding the way it will blend or contrast with other ingredients. It sounds simple in some respects, and yet this is, of course, a fairly complex matter. How have you come to be such a master at doing this, at recognizing flavors and understanding how best to put them together?
Well, I was very lucky that at a very young age I could be with my grandmother's aunt and mother. And one of my grandmother was from Provence, the other one was Italian. My mom was cooking very modern cuisine. So in between soul food and modern and hanging in those kitchens at a very young age, I developed definitely a palate. I was around five, and they were kind enough to let me believe that I was helping them in the kitchen, although I was eating everything they were doing. And being a bad student at age 15, I had to go to work in kitchen, and I developed love for cooking. And and then later on I really find my style, and my style is of cooking is to celebrate the quality of the ingredients. And for instance, at Le Bernardin, which is a seafood restaurant, we pay homage to the fish, and therefore the fish is the star of the plate, and whatever we put in a plate is to elevate the qualities of the fish. And I think you can do that with everything. If you buy a chicken, you should be thinking, how can I make the best chicken ever? And not thinking about, oh, I'm going to do a nice presentation, and or I'm going to do something, and then looking for what goes with it. You know, cooking for something is much stronger in terms of statement and result than cooking with something. Mm. So that was definitely the influence of cooking. And it's translated into our book, Avec Eric, which is our companion book of the PBS series that we have, Avec Eric. In the show and in the book, we start in the kitchen of Le Bernardin, so it's a little bit of a back-of-the-house visit, and then I travel for inspiration, and I am interacting with farmers and growers and fishermen and winemakers, etc. And then I come back to my own kitchen, and I cook something inspired by my my trips and visits, and it's the recipes are easy to make, and they are definitely created for the home cook.
Very good. One of the things you help us understand is some of the challenges that are involved in putting together a recipe. And you tell us that one can go about this in different ways in terms of trying to create a brand new dish. You might start with a dish that already exists and just try to tweak it a little bit, or one might just start absolutely from scratch with no sort of starting point except, you know, just your own, the empty slate and your own imagination. You tell us that there are pitfalls involved in both of those sort of practices. How do you typically go about creating a new dish, and in particular, fashioning the recipe for that dish?
Well, it's again, driven by, I mean, the inspiration is driven by many things. One is the season. The season has a tremendous impact on creativity. The second thing is the ingredients and the surrounding. If you are in the Caribbean, or if you are in Canada in the winter, your inspiration is going to be very different, and I think and your creativity as well. I recommend for beginners to follow recipes all the time, because especially on a book like ours, Avec Eric, where we have tested the recipes very carefully to make sure that everyone has a good result, even if you are very, very a beginner. And then for the confirmed cooks, the book has so many images and pictures and so on. If you are very comfortable in your kitchen, you can definitely use some ingredients, or use one picture or part of a recipe to create your own interpretation of what we have done. And that is what professional chefs do. You look at ingredients, you look at cookbooks, you travel, and then you come back. And because you have the basics of cooking, you are able to create. And it's actually a very pleasureful experience.
We are speaking with one of the world's most renowned chefs, Eric Ripert, talking about his book Avec Eric, which is a companion to the second season of the PBS television series, in which Eric Ripert leaves New York City to visit beautiful places with beautiful food and particularly beautiful ingredients, and then returns to his own kitchen newly inspired. In fact, one of the things, Chef Ripert, that you say in your book is that when one lives in a big city, even a wonderful big city like New York City, it is easy to be disconnected from food sources. I suppose in any urban setting, it's very easy for that to happen. And in a sense, I suppose this experience that you write about and live out in this
television series, it's sort of a way for you to combat that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, being in a city like New York, when you go shopping, you, very often you go to the store and everything is in the package. And or sometimes, you know, I mean, fruits and vegetables are definitely not in boxes, but you don't think about where is it coming from. And it's very important to make those trips to the country and to go visit the people who are at the source and who are passionate about cultivating the land and about growing animals. And it's, I think, essential to be inspired. And for me, it's very often I do that to understand again and have a different respect for the animals and for the vegetables, which are the gift of you know, the bounty that Earth is for us. So I think it's very important. And for instance, right now in the it's the season for apples picking, for the pumpkin, and if you can get out of the city and go to the fields and experience that, I think you come back very refreshed and inspired.
Hmm. One of the visits you talk about in your book is to a couple by the last name of Sandberg, I believe, who own not only a superb restaurant, but also a wonderful farm. And, of course, it's complicated enough to own and operate a restaurant. Put on top of that, to own and operate a farm, it's almost unimaginable. And yet they have made this decision gladly, and you seem impressed by what they have managed to accomplish.
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, it's more and more chefs and restaurateurs who are not living in urban centers are trying to really cultivate the vegetables that they want in their restaurants, or even raise animals, because they want to have the freshest ingredients. And you know, they go to the garden, and an hour later, it's in a plate of the client, and it's a very, very different experience than buying, for instance, vegetables a few days later. A salad coming out of the soil has an incredible delicacy that over the time kind of disappear. And we see a new generation of young chefs that are very inspired to and they like the challenge of not only running the kitchen and the restaurant, but of running a garden. And it's difficult, but a lot of them are succeeding, and they get tremendous pleasure in doing both, cultivating and taking care of the land, and at the same time cooking in their restaurant.
Hmm. One of the things I loved about this book was the chapter called Teamwork, and it reminded me of your earlier book, On the Line, which goes into even more detail in terms of the complex team that is involved in a wonderful restaurant like Le Bernardin. And in this new book, you liken that team in a first-class restaurant to bees, of all things, honeybees. As,
yes.
And you were inspired as you visited some beekeepers at a place called the Melissa Garden out in Sonoma County, California. Tell us how your restaurant resembles a literal beehive of activity.
Well, the restaurant has 140 employees working at the same time, and we have, you know, different aspects in a restaurant in terms of work. We have the reservation office, so we have people taking calls, and we receive up to 1,000 calls a day. And then we have the accounting office, and we have the management office, and then you have the kitchen with 40 cooks working together. You have the waiters with about 40 or 50 waiters, and you have the dishwashers, and everybody has to work in a kind of a limited space, and you have to be extremely efficient. And the goal is to serve clients and to make them happy and to have a great experience. And for that to happen, you have to not only work as a team, as one, but you have to have also a great organization, a lot of solidarity, because it's very often difficult. And I will give you an example. For instance, when you have 50 people eating at the same time and ordering different dishes, you have to have the client has expectations. What they want is the right dish that they ordered to be delicious on the front of them in a timely manner, in a clean plate. And to achieve that for 50 people at the same time or 80 people at the same time, we really work like bees. We work with a great organization, great passion, and we work, again, as a team.
And again, I think for so many of us who have only the vaguest notion of what is involved in making that happen, we learn so much from your books. One chapter in this new book, Avec Eric, is called Craftsmanship. And I so appreciate the way in which you help us to appreciate, for instance, the good work of one of your lead butchers at Le Bernardin, Justo Thomas. Tell us what he does on a daily basis and the ways in which he does it exceptionally well.
Yes. Well, Justo is someone that is a rare individual. He's our fish butcher, and he's basically responsible for receiving the seafood that comes to the restaurant every day. And then he's in charge of breaking down the fish and portioning the fish for the restaurant. And Le Bernardin, being a very successful fish restaurant, we receive about a ton of fish every day. And in a very quick matter, he's able to scale the fish, fillet the fish, portion the fish, take the bones out of the fish, because obviously we don't want any client to have bones in their mouth when they eat a fillet of fish. And he's someone who's extremely organized, extremely clean, very fast, very precise, and he's a master at his craft, really. He's an inspiration for the entire team.
Hmm. I want to just read a moment of what you describe about how he does this. You say, Justo enjoys his job and is a true master craftsman. I have never seen anyone work faster than him at this task. He works very quickly but precisely, leaving no wasted product. When he goes on vacation, it takes three people twice as long to do what he accomplishes by 2 p.m. each day. Justo has a lot of respect for the fish, too, and it is always impressive to watch him work. I think that's so intriguing, the idea of having respect for, in this case, the fish which you are butchering.
Well, you know, we really think that anything that comes to the restaurant has been alive, and we respect the life, especially of animals, very much. And the last thing we want to do is to sabotage a beautiful ingredient, and we pay our respect by cooking it properly or making sure that we come up with a recipe that really is, again, an homage to that product.
Chef Eric Ripert, season 3 of his television series Avec Eric is premiering this weekend on the Cooking Channel. His books include Avec Eric, A Culinary Journey with Eric Ripert, and On the Line, The Stations, the Heat, the Cooks, the Costs, the Chaos, and the Triumphs Inside the Walls of Le Bernardin. Tomorrow on the morning show, one of our interviews will also be about food, specifically about the Mediterranean diet, which many physicians recommend as among the most healthful choices that a person can make. And we're going to be talking with the author of a new book about the Mediterranean diet, and especially how the Mediterranean diet, in her contention, can be even more effective, more healthful when it is wed to a vegetarian diet. So the vegetarian diet will be talked about on tomorrow's morning show. Also, we'll hear more from Mark Moran, an antiques dealer featured on Antiques Roadshow, among others, and he is coming to the Kenosha Public Museum this weekend for a very special event. And we'll hear more of our conversation with him on tomorrow's morning show. Support for the morning show